Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a long drip of tough news from Afghanistan. Today, a tidal wave. 92,000 leaked U.S. military documents covering 6 years up until last December. The documents lay out in detail the hard slog, the dilemmas, the betrayals, and the catch-22s we've all known about. But reading the ground-level exchanges of the U.S. military, well, it's sobering. This hour on Point, the giant document leak and its light on Afghanistan. We'll look at the story in the Afghan war logs. You can join the conversation. Have you dived into this mass of memos up now for all the world to see? What do these documents tell us? And do they change your thinking one way or another about this war? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And to note, we welcome our new listeners today joining us on Wyoming Public Radio. Great to have you. Several weeks ago, three newspapers were given access to the thousands of secret Afghan war reports that are up today at WikiLeaks.org for all the world to see. Reporters from two of those papers join me today. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times, is with us. Mark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And from London, Nick Davies, investigative reporter for The Guardian. Nick Davies, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, that's a pleasure, Tom.
Mark, first to you. How did you, and I guess you, and The Times, and The Guardian, and Der Spiegel in Germany come into receipt of this mass of memos?
One of our editors was contacted about the documents several weeks ago the Times and it was just The Guardian having access to these documents, and we sent one of our reporters to London to take a first look at them, and then for the last at least 2.5 weeks, had a group of reporters in New York sifting through the documents, trying to, first of all, understand them, make sure that they were authentic, and then try to draw themes out of them and big headlines that we could then present to our readers.
Nick Davies, was it the same for you? How did you first learn that these secret documents were available to you?
Well, the way it started was that mid-June, there was a small amount of publicity about the fact that there was a leaks inquiry going on in the Pentagon and that a U.S. intelligence analyst had been arrested in Iraq. And the suggestion, which still remains untested by any court, was that there'd been a big leak to this organization, WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. So I tried to contact the guy who founded it, this Australian man, Julian Assange. Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, there was a borderline of what you might call anxiety around the whole thing. Was Assange about to be arrested? Was there going to be a court order? And he was lying very low. So it took days to find the guy. And then I had a meeting with him. And at that stage, the WikiLeaks, they were poised to what they were saying was, if we are attacked in any way, legal or otherwise, mm-hmm. we're going to put this stuff on our website. And in the meantime, I opened up a negotiation with him, and we agreed, he and I, that it would be much better to allow big, responsible, mainstream media organizations, particularly ourselves and the New York Times, to look at this stuff and try to make sense of it. Because if you just put all this massive material out on a website, who's going to understand it? It's like this kind of huge waterfall of fragments. So as Mark was saying, we then, originally it was his colleague Eric Schmidt, who's a great man, mm-hmm. came to London and we worked together. Der Spiegel also became involved because WikiLeaks had a preceding relationship with them. And then we had this rather unusual relationship where news organizations who usually like to trip each other up and stab each other in the back mm-hmm. worked together, I think, very well. And I hope Mark agrees. We treated each other well and shared information.
You've had time for weeks to absorb this, which is why we're so glad to have you with us today. The rest of the world playing catch-up now. It's, I guess, all up at WikiLeaks.org, except at least where I'm sitting today. That's crashed, and we can't get on to it. Mark, give us a sense of what are these, Mark Mazzetti, what are these 6 years of reports? What's the nature of these reports?
The reports are military incident intelligence reports, operations reports, Some are quite long, some are just snippets, all in sort of dense military jargon that fed into a central sort of clearinghouse. We don't know where they fed into, but it was a central military repository for this information. And the information was coming in from all parts of the country. And some of it is very, very raw reporting. Some of it has been sifted a bit and analyzed by military officials because they comment on it, saying this report looks valid, this report looks like it's untrustworthy. And so part of the painstaking process has been to sort of decipher exactly what these reports mean. The language is hard to understand. Mm. Thankfully, one of our reporters, Chris Chivers, spends a lot of time with the military, and so he could help translate military speak for us. And so it was a fascinating window in how the military sees the war.
Here's the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, at a press conference in London today, not lying low today, and hints that there may be more to come here. But here's Julian Assange talking about this enormous pile, maybe the biggest in history, of leaked military documents. This about the Afghan war.
The real story of this material is that it's war. It's one damn thing after another. It is the continuous small events, the continuous deaths of children, insurgents, allied forces, the maimed people. Most of the deaths in this war are as a result of the everyday squalor of war, not the big incidences.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in London today at a press conference, and as I say, hints that there may be more to come here. Everybody's trying to figure out exactly what to make of this enormous pile of reports. Mark Mazzetti, The New York Times, describes it in many respects more grim than the official portrayal of the war. Nick Davies, The Guardian, goes further, calls it a devastating portrait of a failing war in Afghanistan. Is that a new conclusion as a result of these reports, or is that where The Guardian started lately, Nick? Failing war.
I think in general terms, I don't think the material gives you a big new headline. But what it does do is, looking at the established headlines that we're already interested in, it gives you a mass of new detail and therefore tells you a lot. So, I mean, as an example, clearly we know that there have been incidents where civilians have been caught up and killed in action by the coalition forces. And some of those incidents have been openly described by the coalition. But in this material, you can see a whole lot of examples of that kind of incident, which hadn't previously been disclosed and are here disclosed in great detail. And it must be right that those of us whose brothers and sisters are going out there to fight, or those of us whose money is going to fund this thing, those of us whose security is said to be protected by all this, that we should take account of that in full, and that becomes part of an adult open debate about where we should go from here.
Mark Mazzetti, help us look at what else we've learned here. In particular, this news about heat-seeking missiles in the hands of the Taliban. They're famous, of course, because they helped drive the Soviets out in the 1980s. And at that time, the U.S. supplied heat-seeking missiles to the Mujahideen. What do we learn here about these missiles in this conflict, Mark?
Well, we learned that that the heat-seeking missiles have been used in Afghanistan by the insurgents. The U.S. military has sort of long dismissed this as a weapon in the arsenal of the Taliban. And you know, and the significance is that, as you said, this is what the Mujahideen used to drive the Soviets out in the 80s. It does hint that the insurgents are getting, you know, weapons, you know, getting weapons from, you know, maybe a lot of different places, including over the border from Pakistan. And so it's another one of these windows into the conflict that the public had not been given, because in some cases the military had not wanted this information to get out. And Nick is right. There is no blockbuster headline out of these documents, but it is an amazingly rich portrait of the war that makes you see kind of how, after billions and billions of dollars being spent, in many ways, you know, the enemy is at its strongest it has been since 2001.
And one by one, these really add up. I'm looking at one of the reports out of these 90,000 plus. This is from May 30th, 2007, Helmand Province incident report, downed helicopter, and it's an American CH-47 transport helicopter. At the time, Major John Thomas, a spokesman for the military, said it's not impossible for small arms fire to bring down a helicopter. In this report, Nick Davies, we're reading heat-seeking missile. This is news. Nosedive, crash site, no survivors, 7 soldiers died, including 5 Americans, a Briton and a Canadian. All this new from these leaked documents, Nick.
Yeah, and it is interesting to ask why they hold back information like that and whether they should. I mean, that question runs through the whole thing. I think it's important to say also that the information that we're disclosing, it isn't just about stuff that might cause, you know, anxiety to the public image of the coalition. There's some very, very telling stuff about Taliban behavior in there. So we, for example, have put together a graphic about the use of IEDs, these improvised explosive mm-hmm. devices. And the first thing you see is the rising use, just the sheer scale. The second thing you see as you go into the detail is the casual cruelty with which the Taliban will put down IEDs in public places, and in order to rub out one target with whom they're having a dispute, will casually and happily kill 100 bystanders. I mean, it's grotesque. And if you follow that logic through, there are smaller incidents of Taliban cruelty. I mean, barbaric stuff. There's an incident, for example, where a corrupt senior police officer betrays a junior officer who is taken away and has a rope put around his neck, tied to the end of a car, and is dragged to death round a town by the Taliban.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Afghanistan and WikiLeaks, what we're learning from the massive new leak of U.S. military documents on the war. Mark Mazzetti joins us from the New York Times. Nick Davies from The Guardian in London. Their two newspapers, plus Der Spiegel in Germany, had these documents for several weeks before they came out yesterday in their papers. Today, they're out for all the world to see at WikiLeaks.org. The White House is really upset about this leak. 90-some thousand reports extending from 2004 until last December. The White House says, well, that's exactly when we stepped up with a new strategy because, yes, we saw these problems, but they are not happy with the leak itself, but it is all out there. We'll hear more from Nick Davies and Mark Mazzetti, but joining us right now as well from New York, Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's just come out in recent days in Newsweek magazine last week saying this war is not going to work. Richard Haass, thank you very much for joining us. What do you see in these leaks?
What these leaks do is confirm really two things. One is simply how cruel and resourceful and difficult an adversary is the Taliban. And secondly, and related to that, one of the reasons they are as difficult is that they enjoy not simply sanctuary in Pakistan, but a degree of partnership with the Pakistanis. So at one and the same time that U.S. officials describe Pakistan as our strategic partner, what I believe you're seeing in these emails is more than a little bit of evidence that Pakistan is playing both sides of the street, and they are also a strategic partner of the Taliban, which is one of the reasons that I am as pessimistic, shall we say, about the prospects of this enterprise as I am.
Richard Haass, the White House is essentially saying today, we're not happy that all this is out there, but this is essentially what we've been working with. We know this. The world knows this. There's nothing exactly profoundly new in these reports, and we're on top of it. This is what we're pushing back against, Richard Haass.
Well, on one level, they're right. There is nothing fundamentally new. We didn't need this avalanche of emails and the rest to persuade us about the Taliban, nor did we need this avalanche of emails to inform us that the Pakistanis have, shall we say, agendas that, while they overlap with ours in part, also diverge from ours. But to say that we're on top of it, to say that essentially the new U.S. policy that's been in place over the last year, year and a half, is going to correct for all this, I would think is wildly optimistic. Yes, you know, the United States is taking the fight, as the president described it, to the Taliban, but the Taliban are resourceful, as we're seeing. And it's one thing to push them back. It's something very different to hold and secure an area. And that is clearly a problem that the U.S. is having. This doesn't really get into details about building up the Afghan army and police, but that is a centerpiece of U.S. and NATO strategy. And again, there's lots of reasons to raise doubts about the prospects for building up strong capacities of a central government, given the history of Afghanistan and given the corruption and dysfunctionality of this central government.
Mark Mazzetti, your paper, The Times, makes the Pakistan angle really the lead of everything out of these 90-some thousand reports. Everybody knows there's been sympathy, though, toward the Taliban in Pakistan. What's new in this mountain of leaked documents, Mark, on that front?
No, you're right. The Times and a lot of other news organizations have been reporting that the American intelligence, American and other Western intelligence agencies believe that the ISI is working with the Taliban, the Haqqani network, and other militant groups.
Pakistani intelligence.
What's surprising to us is the fine-grained detail about the reports. Some of them we didn't believe were credible, but some we did believe were credible. We talked to a lot of officials over the last couple weeks about the document, about the state of U.S. intelligence, and they confirmed that that what we saw was broadly consistent with what they believe is happening, which is a pretty active support by Pakistani spies towards these various militant groups, not only in terms of financing, but in terms of training, in terms of equipping. And that, I think the significance is, makes this an already complicated situation even more complicated and difficult if your ally that you're giving $1 billion to a year is actually helping the enemy. And that's what really makes a lot of people scratch their heads.
Nick Davies, what happens with this insight that Pakistan may be doing more than the public at least knew? Obviously, the U.S. government and NATO allies knew this. These were in their official reports. But for example, the former head of Pakistan's spy service, the ISI, from 87 to 89, this is General Hamid Gul. He's fingered in these documents as being actively involved. And now today he's saying, I'm their favorite whipping boy. It's not the first time there's allegations like this. And he comes right out and says, I'm not against America, but I am opposed to what American forces are doing in Afghanistan, he tells the Wall Street Journal. But there he is. He's in Rawalpindi in sort of official high-security neighborhood. Is there no consequence for this kind of insight that we're getting here?
Well, I think what we're doing is first of all, it's right to say that some of the low-level intelligence about ISI involvement with the Taliban looks unreliable and fabricated, but you're left with a core of concern. And what that detail reinforces is the idea that this is an uneasy, unreliable alliance between the coalition and Pakistan. And then if we're trying to look at the big picture, should we stay? Where do we go from here? It's an important factor. And just as a subsidiary version of that, the other thing that the documents reveal is this undeclared border war between the ordinary forces on each side, the Pakistani and Afghani side of the borders, recurrently lobbing small arms fire, rockets and shells at each other, something which on the whole has been underreported, but is clearly a line of friction between these two sides who are supposed to be sharing an alliance.
Let's hear from our listeners. Richard Haas, Nick Davies, Mark Mazzetti, stand by. Richard in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, so much of this war, Tom, is run by remote control. I mean, we're sending the drones over there into Pakistan in particular, and we might be taking out Taliban's, some of the leaders there, but also we do have a lot of collateral damage, and a lot of people are getting killed. And then consequently, especially in Afghanistan now, with all the IED devices that are being created now, more so, we're losing a lot of guys. So, to them, it doesn't matter. I mean, to them, it's there's no difference. Everyone's going to use the resources they have. And as far as the border between the two countries, they're all Pashtuns, and really the border doesn't mean a darn thing to the Pakistanis or the Afghanis.
Which apparently puts Pakistan right in the middle of it. Mark Mazzetti, what about on this drone front? There is a fair amount in these reports on drone activity and some perspectives we had not quite had before, Mark.
Yeah, it's striking in the documents that the extent that the drones have sort of taken over this war. And your caller is right. It's in many ways a remote-controlled war. We do spend a lot of time reporting on the drones in Pakistan, a CIA campaign to sort of target Al-Qaeda guys on the Pakistan side. But what we don't see, what these documents give us, is the extent that armed drones are used in the Afghanistan conflict constantly in every, you know, in almost every major firefight. And so that is one of, I think, the eye-opening things about the documents is just the extent that the military relies on drones to fight modern war.
You report as well, though, that they have pushed American forces into harm's way in some instances, crashing and colliding, and they've got to go out and retrieve that technology so that it doesn't get in Taliban hands, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. They crash a lot. They miss their targets. It's not an unvarnished success that sometimes they're made out to be. So yes, there's instances where they've crashed, and then the U.S. military have had to go in and recover some of the armaments on the drones. So that's another sort of interesting picture about the drone campaign.
Mark, I've only got you for another couple minutes. Give us an anecdote or two that you found most striking in this enormous mountain, sort of unprecedented mountain of leaked material.
Well, one of the interesting anecdotes that we highlighted was it's actually just an exchange in 2008 between the head of the Afghanistan spy service, Amrullah Saleh, and some top military commanders. And he is just talking to them about how his budget's about to be cut because the CIA has basically been bankrolling Afghanistan spy service for 7 years. And they're about to lose their CIA backing, and it's about to get taken over by the Afghanistan government. Mm. And so he's worried about a 30% budget squeeze. So he's basically giving a plea for help to the Americans, saying, you know, if you have any spare AK-47s and boots and ammunition, can you send them our way? Because, you know, our CIA backers are about to abandon us. So that's just sort of an interesting, enlightening, very small picture into this war, and to the extent that the U.S. Is basically, U.S. And coalition forces have basically been running Afghanistan's government.
There's a lot in here about how it was on a kind of a tight diet when the Iraq war was at full bore and Afghanistan was in second place. Also about the pressure on Afghans who cooperate. There's a report here in February of 08 from Zabul province. An Afghan National Army Brigade commander gets a call from the Taliban. Do you recall that one, Mark?
I'm sorry, I'm blanking on that.
Mullah Izzat is reported here, calls up and says, look, we want you to surrender. We'll give you $100,000 U.S. if you'll stop working for the Afghan army. And by the way, we know where your family is.
That's right. And then there's yet another one where there's a secret commando raid in 2007 where a group of Delta Force operators launch rockets and then hit a compound and it turns out the Al-Qaeda operative is not there and a group of children are killed and in the subsequent aftermath the Americans drop a list of talking points for the local governor to sort of calm down the local the local population, calm down their anger. So, again, this is yet another interesting insight into that the U.S. is so active in trying to sort of massage public opinion inside of Afghanistan.
Mark Mazzetti with the New York Times national security correspondent there and one of the Times team reporting on this mountain of leaked material. Mark, thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Nick Davies in London, give us an anecdote or two that struck you most out of this enormous pile.
Well, I thought that there's a pattern of incidents where you can see a really frustrating conflict between, on the one hand, genuine efforts by parts of the coalition to procure support among the ordinary people of Afghanistan. So they go to a village and they hold a shura, you know, a council meeting, mm-hmm. and they say, what are your problems? Okay, you need a new well. We're going to help you build the well. We're your friends. We're not here to kill you. And you can see them building these relationships. And then some other part of the coalition comes in and blasts some part of the village, whether it's with a drone attack or one of these kill and capture operations to take a particular Taliban leader. And that completely undermines all the work, all the bridge building, all the hearts and minds stuff that's been done. And that's a recurrent problem. And with that particular one that Mark mentioned, where they fire five of these HIMARS rockets at a building, they think there's some high-value target mm-hmm. in there. He doesn't seem to me, but they kill seven children. You can see the local political knock-on effect, the destructive effect, as well as the human loss.
Richard Haass, you're looking closely at this. What do you see that's fresh and new to you?
Well, there's nothing that's totally fresh and new. What to me is most important is to take a step back, both what this is and what this isn't. You know, this is not the Pentagon Papers of the Afghan War. You don't have the policy debates within the U.S. government. You don't have the sort of fundamental questioning or assessing of the policy. And second of all, what this doesn't show is the larger question of why Pakistan is doing what it's doing in Afghanistan. And it's the reason that you see the double dealing that we're seeing in all these emails, which is and intelligence, which is that Pakistan continues to see Afghanistan as a strategic battleground, if you will, in their larger struggle as they see it against India. And that's what explains more than anything else why the Pakistanis are playing the multiple games that they are doing. So it's implicit in all of this, but it's not explicit that, again, Pakistan has a very different agenda mm-hmm. than does the United States when it comes to Afghanistan.
Lots of little insights here that add up to a bigger understanding. Here's a report from just last fall, November. A security convoy taking fuel to Kandahar stopped by what's thought to be 100 insurgents armed with assault rifles, machine guns. Turns out that the convoy is being stopped by the local chief of police, at least that's what the reports say, demanding $2,000 or $3,000 per truck. Is it the Taliban? Is it the local police? Who knows? And off the or another here. This is from 2006. An American civil affairs officer shows up at an orphanage that's just been built. Big to-do, ribbon-cutting ceremony. All kinds of expressions of how great, come back a couple months later. Supposed to be 100 kids. There's only 30. Come back again later. There are no kids there. For a holiday, for something else. Who knows? Varda in Norwich, Vermont. Varda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, how are you? I think Julian is a hero to me.
Julian Assange, this is the WikiLeaks founder. Why?
Well, he's done what, you know, the news doesn't really bring you detailed stories, and he has, and this is kind of reminds me of what the underground might have done during World War II against our enemies, bring the truth to the people and let the people know, or during Vietnam, the Vietnam War, where we really saw the war on the screen, on TV, in the news.
But these are American soldiers, Varda. Are you concerned that this will make their job more difficult?
I think the job is going to be difficult regardless. I think, and it's too bad that we're spending trillions of dollars while we have so much suffering and struggling here, and huge tax cuts for rich people. In the meantime, millions of Americans are going without jobs and the economy's not doing well, yet we're just pushing forward on this war that's lasted longer than World War II.
So you're happy to see the information out there, Varda, and we've got that. Here's a post online on the other side of that question. It says, giving civilians information like this is like giving matches to kids. If you don't have a good understanding of something or the harm it can do, you shouldn't be playing with it. Richard Haass, how about it? A net gain from this kind of exposure of secret material, or a loss to the official effort?
Oh, it's hard to net this out. It's probably something of a wash. But one area where it could be a gain is if it reinforces the questioning inside the government, both the Congress and the executive branch, about the policy, and in particular about franchising so much of it out through the Pakistanis. And what I'm hoping that one of the positives that stems from this is a reassessment of the intensity or intimacy of the U.S. working relationship with Pakistan. And, for example, one of the things I've advocated, the United States should begin a dialogue directly with the Taliban. I would not do that through the Pakistanis. Rather, I would do it directly rather than have mm-hmm. them put their spin on everything.
Nick Davies, how about in the U.K.? It sounds as though your country has already been leaning more heavily away from this war. Do you see an impact? We've just got half a minute before the break, Nick, but how is this likely to turn public opinion?
Today, the reaction has been interesting because we weren't sure whether we would run into a whole bunch of hostility. And it's been overwhelmingly on the other side, to a really surprising extent, that we're not being accused of doing something bad or jeopardizing people's safety on the ground. And I would emphasize we haven't done anything like that. There's a huge and sensible interest in the revelations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Afghanistan and WikiLeaks, about a huge leak of U.S. official documents covering 6 years, 2004 right through to the end of 2009, and what we're learning from this massive new leak about the war in Afghanistan. Nick Davies is with us from The Guardian newspaper in London, one of three papers that got the material in advance of its big public release yesterday in their papers, and today all over the world at WikiLeaks.org, including, no doubt, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, where they will be reading with interest. Richard Haass joins us as well from New York, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, out recently saying it's time to wrap this war. He doesn't see how it can be won. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just curious to say that I'm concerned about the consequences of not allowing this stuff to leak. I know a lot of people are worried about national security, but if we don't expose these things for what they are, the practice of our foreign relations continues as is, as the status quo.
So you think it's good to have this out there, John, or not?
I think it's necessary. If it doesn't, then our State Department, as it operates as it is not doing an effective job.
Well, certainly there's a lot more transparency once you have 90,000 reports on the table. I appreciate your call. One more from Iowa, Plainfield, Iowa. Les. Les, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The question I have is nobody has talked about how on earth these 90,000 documents were obtained. I mean, you know, was a Pentagon computer hacked, or it's not just like five emails from one person. It's 90,000 documents. And how the heck do you get that many documents from the supposedly secure, even though these aren't top secret documents, how the heck do you get all those?
It's a great question, Les. Let me put it to Nick Davies first. Nick, okay. There's a lot of speculation out there about this already. What do you know?
Well, the simple reality is I don't know. But in a way, tying together what those last two callers are talking about, this is a really interesting example of the way modern journalism works. And I disagree with the call. I think she was called Varda a few calls ago. Mm-hmm. She said, well, this is great for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks because he's doing something the mainstream media won't do. It isn't that. You've got these two different kinds of media at work. So when I made contact with Julian Assange,
right. He
recognized that we, the news organizations, could do something that he couldn't do. So we've got the resources and the skills to take this material, look for the stories in it, check them, put them out through established, credible channels. These are things that we can do that WikiLeaks can't do. But now there's a really interesting second phase where WikiLeaks have posted masses of this raw material, having removed all those documents which they fear could do any harm on the ground.
Could you hold there for a moment?
Sorry,
did they
okay.
really withhold some documents? I mean, I'm reading there may be more to come. Are they playing that role? I thought they were just a pass-through. I thought they were refusing to play that kind of... will hold some back that traditional media outlets have done historically.
No, it's been an interesting moment for them because their basic beliefs are very purist and uncompromising. All information should be published. But Julian recognized that to the extent there are reports in there which might indicate the identity of a particular village elder who helped coalition troops to arrest a local Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
That guy could be, you know, killed if that's published.
Is that being excised, blacked out of these reports?
So what he's done is what he calls a harm minimization exercise. Now, I can't tell you exactly what that consists of, and I'm not responsible for what he does, but he certainly says he has done that and that they've withheld some 15,000 of the documents in case they do contain anything that could cause that sort of trouble. But the point I'm trying to make is we haven't finished yet. We've done the mainstream media job.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's out there. All sorts of other people, academics, freelance journalists, people who used to be in the armed forces, any interested member of the public can start mining that database to see what is in there. And we haven't got to the bottom of it at all. I mean, if you visualize this, this is like a shelf with 200 good-sized novels sitting on it.
Yeah.
And we've had 3 weeks to kind of plunder it and see what we can find. There's more in there. And as other people move in and spend longer on it, it's this citizen journalism thing, working alongside the mainstream media. And it's a really interesting example of that alliance at work. And then in the background, the question, well, how did WikiLeaks get this information? That's what they're there for. That's part of the new world of journalism as well, that you have a website whose sole purpose in life is to attract material from whistleblowers. And you know they've got it set up so that if you send them an email, that gets kind of laundered through all kinds of clever internet stuff that I don't understand, so that nobody can trace its origin.
We've got more questions on exactly that front, Nick, if I may. Mm-hmm. Richard Haas, stand by. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on.
Hi, guys. A great, great program. Is this part two of the Bradley Manning, the kid who got arrested for leaking papers? That's part of my question. And
Was that the one who with the helicopter video in Iraq that showed the reporters being killed by U.S.?
Part two. And then my other part of the question is, And Richard, you're such a great guy, but you know your report just was like a kick in the gut to me. It's like, is this guy against our fellows? But you're a realist, and I appreciate that. And another part of me is, how do we confront the Pakistanis? Do we send Colonel Kurtz up the Nung River to take out Pakistani military officers and ISI officers? How do we confront these guys?
Great questions, all. Richard Haas, Nick Davies is giving us some of the thinking about where this might have come from, first of all. But there's a specific question, and there's speculation in the media already that this may have been more from the same, Private Bradley Manning, was it, who put out the video of those reporters being killed by American gunfire in Iraq. What about that, Richard? Does that make sense to you? Or about our caller in Iowa saying, how the heck does this get out into the public?
Look, I have no idea how this particular thing got out. I've worked for four different presidents and different administrations, and things get out. People leak for any number of reasons, and by and large, I believe the responsibility is not with the newspapers, but with those who sign pledges not to disclose classified information, and then go ahead and violate those pledges. So I put the onus on whoever coughed up all this material. But again, I have no idea in this particular instance who did it or why they do it. Though I would think, clearly part of the why would seem to be that these are people who have pretty big doubts about the wisdom of this policy, and were quite possibly hoping that by publishing this information, they would increase doubts and opposition to the direction of U.S. policy. Can I say, by the way, the real questions when it comes to this material is there anything in this that will make it harder for the United States to collect necessary intelligence in the future? Is there anything in this material that compromises so-called sources and methods? That's one question. Mm-hmm. Secondly, is there anything that provides operational information that's still current that, again, would jeopardize either the lives of U.S. Soldiers or the lives of those who might cooperate with us? That, to me, ought to be the questions we ask, not whether it makes policymakers feel uncomfortable or not, whether this information is helpful or unhelpful in some larger political context. I believe the questions ought to be more focused than that.
And what about our caller's further question on if indeed Pakistan is leaning in and helping very actively the Taliban? The caller wants to know if there's not some way for the U.S. to lean in and stop that. Colonel Kurtz up the river.
The short answer is it's extraordinarily difficult, and let me explain why. Pakistan is perhaps the most complicated and difficult bilateral relationship the United States has. This is a country with more than 100 nuclear weapons, with perhaps 175 million people. It houses the world's most dangerous terrorists. It sits up against both Afghanistan and India. And quite honestly, this relationship has been uneasy from the get-go. Whether we're supportive of Pakistan or whether we sanction or pressure Pakistan. And quite honestly, either way, we are going to end up with a relationship that's going to have elements of cooperation and elements where not only are we going to go our own in separate ways, but the Pakistanis are going to promote policies that directly go against U.S. interests. So the challenge is, do we try to compartmentalize and work with Pakistan where we can? Do we try to shape their policy as best we can? But also, we've got to keep our eyes wide open that they are going to do these things that are unhelpful, but we can't always come down on them as hard as we want, because as bad as this relationship or as imperfect as this relationship is, it could be a lot worse, and we don't want to do things that potentially undermine Pakistani stability, because, again, bad situations can get worse, and the idea of a fragile Pakistan becoming a failed Pakistan and what that would mean for our efforts against terrorism or our efforts to secure nuclear material would be a nightmare. So our hands are tied by the fact that we are vulnerable to what happens in Pakistan.
Well, that is some handicap. Let's go to Indiana. Katie. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First-time caller, avid listener.
Great to have you. What do you think?
Well, I was just listening, and I completely agree with what your guest was saying about compromising what's going on the war, in the war. A previous caller had mentioned Vietnam and all the media attention that came from that. And I'm only 22 years old, but my mother and father grew up during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was one of those that was on a date with a soldier in uniform and was spit on and thrown popcorn on and called baby killers because of all the media attention. And so I think that now all this attention and the fact that people think we have to know everything that's going on and we have to see every image and every document, I think it's a little ridiculous, and it can compromise, especially the safety of our soldiers that are there.
Katie, we've got the perspective, and we'll put it up here. I've got just on the other side, I've got a web comment here, Katie, from Marianne, who says, the real benefit of this overwhelming amount of information is that it mitigates the creation of fact by biased news outlets, government spin doctors, bloggers. It does not put troops in danger. The war itself does that. Nick Davies, do you see material in here that would cast U.S. soldiers, NATO soldiers, in the kind of bad light that Katie's concerned about?
He's talking about jeopardy on the ground, isn't he? The physical threat to them. But, because I think there are several points that need to be made. First of all, this material stops December the 31st, 2009. And there just ain't any information in there about current operations. It's whatever that is, 7 months old. The second thing is, this is classified secret. And secret sounds very exciting, but actually that's quite a low security categorization. So this is not red hot stuff about superhuman intelligence. This is not about moles inside the Taliban. That isn't there. Just occasionally, as you're reading it, you come across something which suggests something which could put some individual, usually an Afghani villager, in a vulnerable position. And we've made very, very sure that we haven't published any of that. And I don't think that should be a worry about.
But does it put British or U.S. military troops in a bad light? I think that's Katie's interest. She's hearkening back to her mother's tales from the Vietnam War of troops coming home and being seen as, you know, bad people because of their participation in the war. Do you see that kind of material in these reports?
I've been having an interesting experience here in the UK. I've done a series of radio interviews in London. And on at least three of them, I've been up against the same very senior British soldier who actually was in charge of our forces in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first of these studio interviews, he was quite worried about whether or not we were going to cast these guys in a bad light. By the time we'd got to the third one, he'd got his head around what this material was. He says now, I'm glad you've published this because it helps people to understand the confused and confusing situation in which our troops have to conduct their business. That it makes it more real. So it doesn't necessarily it's nothing at all to do with people spitting at them in the street. It helps to explain. It's the fog of war. It's that we're describing.
Richard Haas, yes, please.
There's a piece in today's New York Times by their military correspondent, C.J. Chivers, which talks about one battle in northeastern Afghanistan. He calls it Combat Outpost Keating, which is eerily reminiscent of Black Hawk Down. So it actually once again reflects the heroism, the fear factor, the reality of war. So I don't see in this an agenda or reality that will put American servicemen and women in a bad light. If anything, again, it makes Afghanistan, which has either been an abstraction for many Americans or not even on their political radar screen, it makes it very real and very tangible. And in that case, the people who were involved in this may have unintentionally done us all a favor. I always appreciate it when debates about policy are brought down to the level of reality and people and what it means rather than being argued out at a level of abstraction.
I mean, here's a reality, I guess, that doesn't depend on leaks at all. The Afghan President Karzai is saying today that a new NATO rocket attack has killed 52 civilians in the south of the country. It doesn't take a leaked report to put that out there, and that's pretty tough stuff. Bob in Nashville. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Good day. I think that the publishing of these reports in the long run is going to help us. We have a big problem in Pakistan that has been there from the very beginning. It is a delicate situation. I applaud you guys for taking the time and opportunity to consider what is best for our troops, because...
Oh, Bob, I'm sorry we lost you there. Sorry, I think we lost you. Well, then, Nick, we're going to give it straight to you. Here's from Facebook. Helen says, of course there isn't any outcry in Britain. They've already decided to cut and run in Afghanistan like they did in Iraq. Woo! You can get a little American heat for you, our British guest, Nick. What do you say?
No, well, that isn't true. That's a weird simplification. There's a great big debate that has been going on here, you know, ever since the whole thing started, and it isn't resolved. The government doesn't quite know where it's going with it. Public opinion doesn't understand the picture. I'd say, unlike Mark from the New York Times, who was on earlier, I'm not a specialist. I'm a generalist, and I find it extremely difficult to know what I think about that war, and it's helped me working on this, and so I want the ordinary readers of newspapers also to be helped by it, and it certainly isn't to do with cutting and running. It ain't as simple as that.
Yeah, Prime Minister Cameron, on his visit here to the United States last week, made clear that British troops would be staying through the year 2015. That's hardly cutting and running. But there is a difference. What they're talking about leaving then, whereas the administration policy here is saying we will only leave when conditions on the ground permit. So there is a tension potentially between British policy and U.S. policy, but I don't believe it's fair to describe more than 10,000 troops, British troops being there, say, for another few years as cutting and running.
Richard Haas, we've just got half a minute. Do you see this pushing NATO toward negotiation or a different way, or they'll ignore it and steady as she goes on war policy?
I believe there will be the introduction of a political or diplomatic track, probably involving talks with the directly with the Taliban. At the same time, people try to push the Pakistanis and try to push the government of Afghanistan itself. But the military is there to provide a context to some extent for the politics and the diplomacy, so we're going to see more of the latter.
Richard Haas, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was Director of Policy Planning in the State Department, the Bush, George W. Bush administration, Principal Advisor to Colin Powell, and much more. Thanks for being with us today, Richard Haas.
Thanks for having me.
And Nick Davies with The Guardian in London. You've been very generous with your time and your insights. Thanks for your reporting, and thanks for being with us today, Nick.
Okay, now that's a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. And in Wyoming especially, great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.